morning to all of you. I, at the outset, thank both Dr. Darman and Omar Khan for the invitation to participate in this morning's session. I've been greetings to you all from my institution back home in Belgaum, India. What I'm talking about this morning is some of the work that we have been doing in Belgaum, looking at some of the community-based interventions for reducing maternal and newborn mortality. As members of the Global Network for Women's and Children's Health Research, as well as some other studies done with our collaborators here. Well, of course, the studies are funded by NICHD and the foundations, but there are no financial conflicts of interest. And one other study that we did at that time, looking at misoprostol for prevention of postpartum hemorrhage, was actually an off-label use of the drug. Now, this is something that I need not explain to this audience. We know the mortality burden, both in terms of maternal deaths and newborn deaths globally. What's alarming is India still continues to be the major contributor. And what's even more upsetting is these are still estimates, and I don't think these estimates really capture, you know, the true mortality burden in our communities and in our countries. So therefore, around 6.5 years ago, the Global Network initiated a maternal and newborn health registry with the goal of enrolling every pregnancy in predefined geographical areas in our countries. And the Global Network sites are in South Asia. There's another site in India, Pakistan, Kenya, Zambia, recently the Democratic Republic of Congo has joined in, and then there's also a site in Guatemala. So we try to register all the pregnancies in our study clusters, and we track the pregnancy outcomes through 42 days postpartum. What I am presenting here today is the data from just our site in Belgaum. So in the first 6 years of the registry, we have around 130,000 pregnancies in our database just coming from Belgaum, and this is about a third of the total registry database. Across the network, we have more than 430,000 pregnancies in our registry. And we have done fairly well with our tracking system. We have close to 100% follow-up, both in terms of capturing the delivery outcome as well as the six-week status of the mother and the newborn. Now, when we look at the maternal adverse indicators, and the first two, miscarriage and MTP rates, there's really no hard data coming from India which actually reports these numbers. So I think this is perhaps the best estimate that we have indicative of the early pregnancy losses, either spontaneous miscarriage or medical termination of pregnancy. Maternal mortality ratio, again, we are in South India, somewhat better compared to the national average as well as in majority of the states in the north. But even then, the rate is still fairly high. When we look at the causes of maternal deaths, again, there's something that we still need to work on. We have a small portion where, you know, the cause is still not ascertained properly. But among the reported causes of death, hemorrhage, preeclampsia, eclampsia, and sepsis kind of stand out as the three major contributors to maternal mortality. So the first study that we initiated, and this was 13 years ago in 2001, was to look at the first, and this was the first community-based RCT of oral misoprostol for prevention of postpartum hemorrhage. And what we found is that misoprostol administered prophylactically does reduce significantly both primary PPH and severe postpartum hemorrhage. A very good number needed to treat of 1:18. It also decreases the need for, you know, additional interventions, referrals, and all that. But as perhaps everybody in this audience knows, misoprostol is associated with certain adverse effects or side effects in terms of shivering and fever. Although these are self-limiting, and different studies report different proportion of women experiencing these conditions, it is a good alternative to oxytocin in settings where refrigeration is not possible, because oxytocin is heat labile. It's an injectable, so in settings where you are looking for an alternative which can be administered orally, which is heat stable, misoprostol does stand out as a good alternative, but has the problems of these side effects associated with it. So basically the goal has been to look at optimizing the prophylactic strategies. And one of the options that we looked at was, rather than medicating everybody, I mean offering universal prophylaxis, can we medicate fewer women without losing on the efficacy of the strategy? So we looked at comparing primary prevention versus early treatment, or secondary prevention as if one may call it, wherein 800 micrograms of sublingual misoprostol is administered only to those women who bleed in excess of 350 milliliters. With the idea that we'll have to medicate fewer women, and therefore fewer women will have adverse effects, the cost definitely will go down, and perhaps it will be more acceptable to the community. The result, the rationale for picking up on 350 ml was based on a large data set that Genity Health Projects has in terms of measured postpartum blood loss, because many of you are aware again that we don't really have good measured blood loss reports in many of the PPH related studies. So this 350 was chosen from an analysis of those studies where a measured blood loss is available, and that's how we selected 350 ml as a sort of an arbitrary trigger, but with the idea that we'll medicate fewer than 25, a quarter of the women. So we did a cluster RCT. The deliveries conducted by the ANMs constitute the clusters, so they were assigned to either universal prophylaxis arm or the early treatment or the secondary prevention arm. This was done in Bijapur district in northern Karnataka, a fairly backward rural district where we still have a reasonably large proportion of home births conducted by auxiliary nurse midwives. And what we found is that the secondary prevention option is in fact non-inferior. We can't say that it is superior, because the 95% confidence interval crosses zero, so we can't really say that it's superior to universal prophylaxis. But compared to the non-inferiority margin of 7%, the secondary prevention group had 5.9% incidence of postpartum hemoglobin on at 72 hours of less than 7.8 gram per deciliter. So, not unexpectedly, again, if you look at the side effects profile, the secondary prevention group will definitely have fewer reported incidents of fever and shivering, but the fact remains that the side effects don't go away. And in fact, when we are using a higher dosage of 800 micrograms sublingual, we can expect that the women who receive this secondary prevention would continue to experience, you know, the side effects. Another analysis that came out of our earlier misoprostol trial was that over the course of the study, there was a reduction in postpartum hemorrhage rates in both the treated group as well as in the control group. And when we looked at, you know, some additional analysis, what came out was perhaps the skills of the ANMs changed over the course of the trial, and that was the reason why there was a reduction in PPH rate in both the treatment as well as in the control group. If you recall, WHO recommends active management of third stage labor as the standard management, and comprises of the administration of a prophylactic uterotonic, controlled cord traction for placental delivery, uterine massage, and delayed cord clamping. And so WHO initiated a multi-center trial looking at what's the relative contribution of controlled cord traction to this whole PPH prevention strategy. And the results show that CCT really doesn't offer any additional benefit. On the other hand, CCT is something that is a procedure that can only be done by skilled birth attendants, so we cannot really roll out Amstel in a community setting where we still are struggling with skilled birth attendants. So what's really critical in our battle against postpartum hemorrhage is to administer a uterotonic. And what we are looking for is the ideal uterotonic, assuming oxytocin to be the gold standard. Oxytocin has two major limitations. One, it is heat labile, so it requires refrigeration. And number two, it's an injectable, so it cannot be practiced by especially traditional birth attendants working in many of our developing countries. So what's come out as an alternative, and we are right now working on a new study under the WHO umbrella, is looking at carbetocin, which is a heat-stable variant of oxytocin. So it takes care of one major limitation of oxytocin. But I think that still is the semi-final. The final, hopefully, is a new oxytocin variant that's being developed in Australia by one group, which is looking at coating nanoparticles with oxytocin and can be used as an inhaled option. So that's where we stand with respect to our effort at identifying solutions for maternal mortality from postpartum hemorrhage. Switching gear, if we look at the newborn mortality scenario, again, as Dr. Derman mentioned in his introductory remarks, we have done well in reducing under 5 mortality and infant mortality, but the newborn mortality still remains a major challenge. A perinatal mortality of 50, close to 50 per 1,000 live births is something that we cannot afford to bear or continue to live with. So we need interventions which can address this this major problem. If you look at the causes of stillbirths and neonatal deaths, prematurity or low birth weight and birth asphyxia come out as the major contributors. Almost 2/3 of the neonatal deaths can be attributed to either birth asphyxia or low birth weight and prematurity. So again, one of the major efforts that we started out in 2005 was training community birth attendants for newborn resuscitation. This was the first birth trial which has been reported earlier. And as part of that, we tested the WHO essential newborn care curriculum, including bag and mask ventilation. And at the time this trial was conducted, more than 1/3 of our deliveries used to be conducted at homes by traditional birth attendants. So we ended up training a large number of TBAs as part of this trial. What was encouraging was that we were able to reduce the perinatal mortality, that's both stillbirths and the early neonatal mortality, by ENC training. Now that led to actually the AAP revising the NRP program and customizing it for community settings for training lesser skilled birth attendants working outside of tertiary care centers. And that's the Helping Babies Breathe initiative. We were one of the sites which did the beta testing of the curriculum. So we ended up training a pool of master trainers who are continuing to work in our area. And even in that small validation study, we were able to show a reduction in fresh stillbirths, indicating that this is something that is feasible to roll out and has the potential of achieving a reduction in early neonatal deaths. Now that eventually led to a larger multi-center trial that was completed last year, in last October, with our site, the other Indian Global Network site in Nagpur and Kenya, participating in this pre-post evaluation of the HBB rollout on a larger scale. Now, HBB kind of stands out in several aspects. One, the focus is on initiating bag and mask ventilation in babies who fail to breathe spontaneously within the first minute of life. The training approach is to work in pairs, and we in fact mix the participants. So nurses, nurse midwives, physicians, OBGYNs, pediatricians, they all work together in the training sessions. So they learn from each other, they teach each other. There's a heavy focus on skill exchange during the training. As a follow-up, we ask the people who have been trained to do a daily drill before they're entering the labor room on a mannequin. And we conduct periodic, every 6 months, a refresher training with the trained people. We also encourage the birth attendants to do a resuscitation debriefing and death audit with the idea that, they can learn from their own experiences and try to improve their skills over a period of time. And we provide supportive supervision from the central team. So again, we ended up training a fairly large pool of birth attendants, but here, unlike First Breath, the focus was on facility-based birth attendants. So we trained about 70 facilities across the spectrum, primary care to tertiary care, and you'll see the mix between Kenya on one end, where predominantly we had primary health centers or primary care facilities, to Nagpur, where we had majority tertiary care centers. Belgaum is somewhere in between. We are still looking at the data, we are analyzing and we are trying to understand what the data says. We didn't get the anticipated reduction in perinatal mortality as much as we had hoped for or we had expected. And I think we were a little overambitious in the design of this study. What we did was to train facility-based birth attendants, and we're hoping that will have an impact on the community-based mortality rates. We were able to reach out to a maximum of 44% of the registry births because we were limited to facilities with a certain volume. So the results may appear a little disappointing because we didn't get the anticipated reduction, but I think we were perhaps overambitious, and we were also overambitious in trying to reduce our mortality rate within a 1 year time frame, which is a reasonably short time frame for people to learn new skills, adopt them, implement them, especially when we have a large turnover of the birth attendants also in these hospitals. We did find some site differences. Kenya, which started out with a fairly higher perinatal mortality, was able to show a larger reduction, whereas in Belgaum and Nagpur, where the baseline mortality rates were lower, we didn't get as much of a reduction. And there was some changes in the profile in terms of the proportion of low birth weight babies, C-section rates, and the prior resuscitation training in the birth attendants also. Which brings us to this whole issue of facility-based births, and this is something that has been advocated by WHO, that in order for reducing mortality, facility births by skilled birth attendants is the goal for our countries. We have been able to shift the births to the facilities, and you see that the shift is rather dramatic. We have almost 95% of the births occurring in facilities now compared to around 60 about 5 years ago. But that has not really translated into a reduction in perinatal mortality. So we tested a package of intervention comprising of community mobilization, SPA training, and strengthening of services at facilities. This is sort of a home to hospital continuum of care model that we used as a conceptual framework for the trial. As I said, three distinct components: community mobilization, SPA training, and strengthening of the facilities. At least in our site, we are able to show a fairly large reduction in perinatal mortality through the intervention, as well as in early neonatal mortality. But what we also found in the facility assessments was that services and availability of qualified staff went down over the course of the study. So the lesson from both HVB and EMOM is that it's not just enough if we get women to deliver in facilities. Facilities are not buildings, but facilities are places where the required services and supplies are supposed to be available. So unless we do a real strengthening of the health system and offer those emergency services and supplies, we are not going to make a huge dent in mortality. So that's sort of the summary from both these studies. As part of the registry, we are also looking at the nutritional status of the pregnant women. And again, not surprisingly, half the population is anemic. About 40% of the women are stuck, have a low BMI. Now, this is the scenario in the first trimester of pregnancy. So obviously, this is not something that they are developing in the first 3 months of their pregnancy. This is something that they are carrying from the preconception period into the pregnancy. We also looked at the food insecurity status in a cross-section of our population, and what we find is about 15% of the women have some kind of food insecurity. And we are still an agrarian economy based on or dependent heavily on the monsoon. And one bad monsoon can change this scenario dramatically. So therefore, we are still dealing with a large nutritional issue. Whatever strategies we have currently are targeting the first trimester onwards, whether it's iron and folate supplementation, promotion of exclusive breastfeeding or complementary feeding. All of those interventions are beyond 12 weeks of gestation. But I think the real window of opportunity is either around conception or in fact maybe even pre-conception. So right now we have just started a new community-based trial looking at providing a lipid-based nutritional supplement to the women. This should help. We're not really saying whether we should supplement or not. The real question that the study is trying to address is, what is the right time for the supplementation? Should it be as per the current norms from second trimester onwards, or should we be actually starting the supplement prior to conception? So, as I said, this study has just been rolled out. We'll have results hopefully by end of 2017. So I would conclude by saying that We have come a fair distance, but I think there is still a long way to go. There is no respite from our efforts. As part of the registry, we typically get about 10 maternal deaths a year. Last 1 month was a nightmare. We had 8 maternal deaths just in our study areas. So things can change dramatically. The health system is still fragile, needs a sustained effort from everyone involved if we are really going to make a huge dent in this. So I end this presentation with thanking all of the agencies which are supporting us in our effort. So thank you.